Good morning. I'm Elizabeth Harrison in Providence. The legislative session is drawing to a close, but before it ends, Rhode Island Public Radio's Flo Jahnik takes a look at some of the key bills that have been passed.
Prospective employers will no longer be allowed to ask if an applicant has been convicted of a crime under so-called Ban the Box legislation approved by the General Assembly. The law applies to employers with at least 4 employees. It allows them to ask about a person's criminal past only in the interview process and beyond. And victims of violent crime will be getting some help with moving expenses if they need it. The General Assembly has approved a bill providing up to $2,500 in relocation costs through the Crime Victims Compensation Program, which already provides help with crime scene cleanup and burial costs. The legislature also approved an increase in the minimum wage from $7.75 to $8 an hour, and it authorized the expenditure of $1 million to upgrade Harrington Hall, the state's largest homeless shelter. Flo Jahnik, Rhode Island Public Radio.
Rhode Island saw its first medical marijuana festival yesterday in Providence in a parking lot on Kinsley Avenue. About 2 dozen vendors sold marijuana paraphernalia and growing equipment. The event was sponsored by the Rhode Island Patient Advocacy Coalition, a group that fought to legalize medical marijuana in the Ocean State. Visiting the festival was Peter Benson of North Kingstown. He was paralyzed in a bicycle accident and says he takes marijuana to ease the pain of muscle spasms.
I found it to be the most effective product that I could use to actually kill my muscle spasms in their tracks. I tried many various muscle relaxers and other pills, and wasn't happy taking the pharmaceutical drugs, and gave the medical marijuana a try, and the results are amazing, so there was no need to go back to the pills.
Although Rhode Island now has 2 medical marijuana retail stores, many patients are still getting the drug from caregivers, people authorized to grow marijuana for medicinal use. The trial of the now infamous gangster James Whitey Bulger continues today in a Boston courtroom. Rhode Island Public Radio's John Bender reports the jury is likely to hear from Bulger before a recess for the July 4th holiday.
Jurors in the Whitey Bulger trial are scheduled to hear from the man himself early this week as prosecutors introduce some of his recorded jailhouse phone conversations. Also scheduled to be questioned are 2 former drug dealers and the daughter of a murder victim. Today's testimony is scheduled to begin with continued questioning of one-time FBI agent John Morris. Bulger's lawyers are relying heavily on the time he allegedly spent as an FBI informant, something the defense has been working hard to discredit. Bulger is charged with many crimes, including participating in 19 killings. He has pled not guilty. John Bender, Rhode Island Public Radio.
And a black bear has been generating 911 calls in the western part of Rhode Island. The animal was last seen on Keach Dam Road in Gloucester early Sunday morning. Earlier sightings were reported in Burrillville and North Smithfield. Residents were being warned not to feed the bear and to report any sightings to the State Department of Environmental Management.
I'm joined by John M. Barry, New York Times bestselling author of several books, including his latest titled Roger Williams and the Creation of the American Soul, Church, State, and the Birth of Liberty. And the topic of our conversation is the Rhode Island Royal Charter, which was signed by King Charles II this month in 1663. John, our listeners are pretty smart people, but for those who don't know what the Charter is, please explain it and its role in world history.
Well, basically, it's the first really firmly legally grounded document guaranteeing separation of church and state and freedom of religion.
How unusual was this for the 17th century, the Western world?
It was extremely unusual. Really, it was a product of a long process, less something that was granted by the king than a movement that was created by Roger Williams, which culminated in this royal charter. In England, Quakers, for example, and some other dissenters were still being sent to prison, but in Rhode Island, they were free to pursue their beliefs. There had, of course, been a civil war. King Charles II, who granted the charter, his father had been beheaded during the Revolution, and Williams had written his own governing compact 25 years earlier, which separated church and state. Absolute separation. Then he had gotten a parliamentary charter from the revolutionary government. Cromwell confirmed it, but of course the king came back. Cromwell was dead, and the colony needed the legal authority, which only the king could provide, and this confirmed what they were already doing.
Why did Charles sign it? What was in it for him?
Well, he overruled his advisors, for one thing. I think the main reason was he was reputed to be a secret Catholic. Whether that's true or not, it's impossible to know, but he certainly converted to Catholicism on his deathbed, although he, of course, had headed the Church of England. Catholics were not popular in England, and very few Protestants wanted to tolerate Catholics at all. Roger Williams was easily the most vocal person in terms of allowing Catholics to worship. So I think there was a lot of sympathy in Charles's mind for creating this little island in the world where religion could be followed freely. You could do whatever your conscience directed you to do.
How did the colonists go about getting this charter?
Williams was banished by Massachusetts chiefly because he believed in separating church and state. He believed that the government had no business interposing itself between an individual and God. And he created Rhode Island, and Massachusetts and other New England colonies viewed this as a festering corruption that might infect them. There were all sorts of threats of imperial intervention from Massachusetts. The Massachusetts marched soldiers into Warwick and seized territory down there. And that threat that Rhode Island would be absorbed by Massachusetts and the Plymouth colony and the idea of freedom of religion would be snuffed out, that galvanized everybody in Rhode Island to get together and to send Williams to London to get the first parliamentary charter.
So he went there himself? I thought they sent Dr. John Clark.
Well, Williams went twice. First, to get the initial parliamentary charter, which came in 1644. That's the year that his book, The Bloody Tenet of Persecution, probably the most comprehensive defense and argument for the separation of church and state ever written. There were political problems in Rhode Island. That parliamentary charter was never really accepted by Massachusetts, and Rhode Island came under more serious threat again a few years later, so Williams returned, and this time he returned with John Clark.
I noticed that the most important portion of the charter is way down at the bottom, after all the hereases and whereby's and so forth. Is that characteristic of the writing of this period? Do you know?
It's characteristic of practically any legal document. I serve on levy board in New Orleans, and whenever we pass a simple resolution, it's always at the bottom. You have 15 whereas clauses above it, so that's still true today.
Now, the charter remained in effect for quite a long time, didn't it?
Yeah, well after all the other colonies after the Revolution rewrote their own colonial documents to be more consistent with the idea of democracy, Rhode Island was a democracy. No royal governor was appointed of Rhode Island, whereas there were royal governors elsewhere. And they kept their colonial charter until they rewrote their state constitution after the Dorr Rebellion in 1842.
I would encourage all of our listeners to visit the State House to look at this document. It's encased in a glass-fronted vault. It's about 5 feet long by 3 feet wide. It's a handwritten parchment document. And in remarkably good condition considering its age. John, a final thought for what should Rhode Islanders take away from this, the 350th anniversary of this document?
What I learned when I started writing the book, I thought I was writing about the freedom of religion. And I learned very quickly I was writing about freedom itself. In Williams's mind, you did not separate the two. He was not the first person in the world to call for the separation of church and state. He was the first person in the modern world to say that a government was subject to its citizens rather than people being subject, the very word subjects, to the government. He said a government has no more power nor for a longer time than the people agreeing bestow them with. And as commonplace as that seems today, that was the first time it had ever been stated in the modern world. It was an extraordinarily extreme statement. for individual freedom.
I've been speaking to John M. Barry, author of Roger Williams and the Creation of the American Soul, which has gotten rave reviews. It's a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize and winner of the 2013 New England Society of Book Award. John, continued success with your book, and thank you very much for spending some of your time in Providence with Rhode Island Public Radio.
Thank you. My pleasure.
The U.S. Supreme Court's 5-4 decision overturning a crucial part of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act does not apply uniformly across the 50 states. While lawyers on both sides of the issue parse the meaning of the ruling, one aspect is clear. Same-sex couples seeking the benefits and clarity of marriage will be better off in one of America's 12 states that recognize gay unions. Rhode Island becomes one of those states on August 1st. When the same-gender marriage law approved by the General Assembly and signed by Governor Chafee takes effect. Gay marriage advocates, for the most part, use civil rights and equality arguments to secure this political victory. But now that the High Court has ruled, the economic impact is beginning to sink in. There are more than 1,100 places in federal law where a protection or responsibility is based on marital status, according to lawyers for national gay rights organizations. A few obvious examples: access to Social Security survivor's benefits, the right to use the federal family medical leave law to care for a spouse, access to veteran spousal benefits, and the opportunity to sponsor a foreign-born spouse for U.S. citizenship. This is still a murky area of law. Federal agencies have widely divergent approaches in which states' laws they consider to determine whether a marriage is valid. For example, the IRS and Social Security Administration rely on the laws of the state where a couple lives, but immigration officials use the law of the state in which the couple was married. One thing is certain, says Karen Lowy, a New York lawyer who specializes in gay marriage issues, is that the Supreme Court decision does not mean that gay couples who live in states with no recognition of gay marriage will be eligible for federal-based marriage benefits. Lowy's advice to gay couples seeking full respect and benefits of their marriage is to live in a state with legal protections for same-gender marriage. The DOMA case that led to the Supreme Court decision was directly related to a marriage-based economic entitlement. It involved an 84-year-old widow who was forced to pay more than $360,000 in federal estate taxes after the death of her female spouse because her marriage was not recognized under federal and state laws. Had she been married to a man, she would not have had to pay that tax. Rhode Island should quickly seize this decision as an asset to our small state. Our economic development officials ought to begin an advertising campaign reminding gay couples that the Ocean State honors their marriages and that we're a fine place in which to raise a family. We could also hang out a sign saying that our state's a great place to retire for couples who want access to federal benefits and such marriage benefits as spousal visiting privileges at hospitals. It may be too early to quantify the economic upside for our state. Surely the DOMA decision will beget more litigation as gay couples rush to the courthouse to clarify their rights. And it would help if our business community would create more jobs and recruit gay employees as they seek a diverse workforce. Former Providence Journal columnist M. Charles Baxt discovered a notable example of a celebrated gay person who refused to live in Rhode Island when our state did not recognize gay unions. Paula Vogel, the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright, said in 2005 that she lived in Massachusetts while teaching at Brown University because she did not wish to live in a place where, quote, I do not have full civil rights. How many other Paula Vogels are out there who no longer will have to make that decision?